Dr. Westbrook,
Dr. Baffa,
and Yasha Khan.
Hey, everyone.
Hello and welcome to the Two Doctors Podcast. This is Dr. Baffa, and I'm joined by the esteemed one and only Dr. Jonas Westbrook. And tonight, for the millions listening out there, we have a very special guest, Yasha Khan of Norwood Weightlifting. Correct, Yasha Khan?
That's right. I think it's Team Norwood now.
Team Norwood. Nice. Team Norwood. Yash is going to be discussing his background, his experiences with the various Russian and Eastern former Soviet bloc personalities that have spent time on the Norwood couch and touring the U.S. But first, I think we should maybe take a couple quick questions before we get into it, Dr. Westbrook. What do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, we had a couple questions on our, I believe, our Facebook and Twitter. One of which was asking how Dr. Baffa and myself sort of got started in weightlifting, and of course, where and how our enthusiasm grew to the point that it is today. So Dr. Baffa, how did you originally get into it?
I first found Olympic weightlifting when in 1996 I was forbidden by my parents from going down to the Jersey Shore one night. this is all serious. And it happened to be, it must have been sometime in August, I guess. It was when the 96 Summer Olympics were playing.
Oh, wow.
And NBC was playing its, like, crappy coverage of the weightlifting back then. And Naeem Suleymanoglu was lifting. It was when he won what was to be his last gold at the Olympics.
That's right, yeah.
Against Valerios Leonidas.
Right, and what a battle that was.
Oh, my God. Exactly. I mean, it came down to the last lift, and Valerios, you know, couldn't stand up with, what was it, 190, I believe?
Something around there. I mean, again, above world record weights. I mean, I think there was probably four clean and jerk world records that were broken that day.
Probably the record's still being broken in that meet. That's how impressive. I saw Naeem lifting, and we were probably about the same size back then, and thought that is something I want to do. So that was it. I used an early version of the interwebs to, like, find a training program, and eventually started out with East Coast Gold, lifted for a little over a year or so, and then dropped out of it until going to Rutgers in 2000-something.
Very good. Now,
Dr. Westbrook.
Now, I sort of have a similar story. Not quite. I mean, the meet that I was that first got me interested was not a world meet, but it happened to be the one and only New York State Empire State Games.
Was it really?
My older brother Adam started to get into weightlifting, and that was one of his first meets that he lifted in. So I went to watch, and it was when the Empire State Games were in Albany. So I can't even remember what year that was now. Probably 2000, maybe somewhere around there. And I went, and I thought it was the greatest thing. And this was, you know, obviously sort of just a local meet. And I was just so impressed by the lifting and the whole thing. So I said I had to get involved into it. So and of course, training for sports, football, basketball, that sort of thing. I was doing some of the really poor power, you know, power movements, squats, some power clean, stuff like that. So just sort of blossomed from there. And of course, you know, after studying some of those early on weightlifters like Dimas, Kakashvili, things like that, you just, the enthusiasm grows and grows.
Yeah.
And then of course, Dr. Baffa and I, sort of mid-career, got to the point where we were lifting in the same weight class and lifting against each other.
That's right.
In multiple national events, American Opens, Nationals, so before we knew each other as podcasters, as friends, as enthusiasts, we were fierce competitors.
We were fierce competitors for that mid-tier, for mediocrity, basically. It was a race to the middle for
well, yeah, we were both striving for mediocrity. I don't think we even got there.
And then we became friends on the downslope of our weightlifting careers. So once we competed against each other for a few years, and then you moved to Maine for dentistry in 2000, 2011.
Yep. Yeah.
And then I moved up there for art history doctoring. And then we became, luckily we were the only two weightlifters, I think, north of Portland.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, and I really, if you include south, you're only talking about one or two weightlifters at Risto's place. So we were two of maybe four weightlifters in the whole state of Maine.
Exactly. Now, Yasha, how did you get your start in weightlifting?
I think when I was a wrestler in high school, we did some very basic hang cleans, like the type that people do for football. Mm-hmm. And I was a wrestler for a long time. And at some point around 2002, 2003, 2004, I was in a local gym doing my just weight training for wrestling, And some older guy comes up to me and tells me that he's a weightlifter, weightlifting coach, and that he wants to coach me. And I've never heard of weightlifting before. I didn't know that it was a sport.
Really?
But he said that if he coached me, then he can make me a state champion, which in wrestling was a big deal.
Now, you were quite a competitive wrestler in your day. Is that correct?
I wrestled a little bit.
Yeah? Okay.
This is interesting, Yasha, because you were born in Moscow, correct?
Yep. Yep.
So you're born in Moscow. You emigrate to the U.S. when you are how old?
Five.
So you emigrate to the U.S. when you're five. Are both your parents Russian?
Yes.
And yet you had no sense of Olympic weightlifting.
No, it's not genetic. Yeah.
I guess I assumed that being born in Russia, it's in your blood.
It's absolutely. So
my parents knew more about weightlifting. My parents knew more about weightlifting than I did for the first couple of years of me weightlifting, just because in Russian culture, like, they knew all the major Olympians, all the champions, just because they were popular figures in Russia.
Sure.
Okay. Wow.
So they would ask me if I've heard of these names, and I wouldn't. I didn't know them. Hmm. And so when Lev Epstein came up to me in the gym, my coach, I didn't really care about weightlifting, but you have to respect the elders. And I nodded and I said, okay, if he wants to coach me, then let's try this. Mm-hmm. And for maybe a couple of months, I was training both wrestling and weightlifting, and then realized I can't keep doing both. So I decided to try weightlifting for a little bit, get a little stronger, and then go back to wrestling. Mm-hmm. And I never did that. I just kept going with weightlifting and just fell in love with it.
Now, your coach, Lev Epstein, he was a really phenomenal masters weightlifter. Is that correct? I mean, really one of the best in the world, right?
Yeah, really good. When he was 80, he was still training 5 days a week.
Wow.
Doing everything. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible.
And he was a weightlifting coach his whole life. He, because of the blockade, because of World War II, he started the sport late and was very underfed and took a while to get healthy. Mm-hmm. But then he remained a coach for his whole life in Russia. And then when he came here, I had him all to myself. So a wealth of knowledge.
That's great.
And and that's where you, Jonas, and I met.
Yep.
We didn't really have a place to lift with Lev, but there was Donny Venturosa in Norwood who had a gym, who just said, anyone that is a local lifter that wants to come here, here's a key.
Mm-hmm. Donny Venturosa has just really taken this sport with open arms in terms of allowing lifters to train there. I mean, this was back when, I mean, we were lifting when his plow truck, you know, literally was touching
halfway over the platform.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some days you show up there after driving for half an hour, and there's a salt truck that's all the way over the platform, and okay, just turn right back around and go home.
Yeah, that's not a successful training day when that happened. But then, of course, in addition to Donny Venturosa, there's you know the one and only from Boston, our favorite, who a guy we see at all the national events, Dennis Reno. Who's a great coach in his own right, who was there always sort of keeping a keen eye on our technique and giving us a lot of feedback during that whole time also.
Yeah, he's still a permanent fixture of Norwood Training Center. He was there today, comes in at least a couple times a week when he's around, not at major competitions, mm-hmm. coaches anyone that is there. Mm-hmm. So we have a good setup.
Yeah, that's great. And now, Yasha, you are the New England snatch record holder in the 105 kilogram weight class with a snatch of 156 kilos. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
That's impressive. Yeah. And you're also a national and American Open medalist in the past too, correct?
No, never medaled at American Open.
Right. Because they didn't give out medals for the individual lifts. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
But I think three times at nationals and once at university nationals.
That's fantastic. That's great.
Third place every time.
Hey, it's on the podium. Hey, if you're stepping up, regardless of what step that is, you're in a good place.
Yeah, always in the snatch or in the total as well? Or
Total. Snatch a couple times second and third, and total every time third.
Okay.
That's fantastic. Now, I am anxious to hear about some of your experience traveling along with quite literally the best weightlifters in the world, names including Ilya Ilyin, Dmitry Klokov, Vasily Polovnikov, and as of recent, one of the strongest guys in the world,
Mike Graber. Oh, not Mike. Who was it?
Mikhail Kokleyev.
Mikhail Kokleyev. He was my second choice. It's another Michael, essentially.
Right.
Mikhail Kokleyev.
I apologize for my brutal pronunciation.
We're going to be butchering Russian names all night long.
But so what were some of the, especially going back first to the seminars and things that you did with Ilya Ilyin and Dmitry Klokov and Vasily, what were some of the big things that you pulled from, spending time with those guys over that long period of time?
I don't know where to start. So you know how all of us American weightlifters, up until recently, there was no access to really good information, like world-class information about training, about technique, about all these things. We had access to YouTube, but that was very limited. And then when these guys decided to come here and do the seminars, we understood that the situation is that they come from a different culture, meaning different country, but also they all grew up in a training center where it's only around other professional weightlifters. And the information that they had has a lot to do with professional training in the sport and not much to do with why the people that wanted to go to the seminars would go to the seminars.
Yeah.
Like the weekend warriors, mostly CrossFitters, some weightlifters, like American weightlifters, the concepts that they discuss normally, the Russian weightlifters, just wouldn't be understood by the seminar attendees just because it's
advanced.
It's not just that it's advanced, it's a different culture. It's a different language, even if I translate it.
Yeah, I see.
So we had a lot of trouble, so they had like one concept of what the snatch is. Mm-hmm. And it was so different from my concept, like what I understood the snatch to be, so that when we started discussing the seminars originally with Vasily Polovnikov, before we started discussing the seminars, I had him teach me the lifts. I had him coach me for a while. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't understanding what he was telling me because my concept of what a snatch is was so different from what his was. So the cues that he was giving me, I wasn't understanding. The context was different.
Yeah.
Could you expand a little bit on what you mean by the way you conceptualize? Because what I'm getting is that you conceptualize the snatch in a way that was different from the way they conceptualize the snatch. Is that right?
Yeah. Like, one of the big things was pull longer, which I just didn't understand because I always thought the arms, the upper body shouldn't work in Olympic weightlifting. It's not a part of the lift. It should be legs and back, the major muscles. Mm-hmm. And so he would sit next to my platform with his like hand half covering his eyes and just saying, no, higher, no, longer. And I had no idea what he's talking about. And I asked him, like, what do you mean? He just pulled longer, so I tried to use my back more to get the bar higher. And then finally, we decided to just break it down just with the bar so that every centimeter I understood what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then finally, like I started understanding more what he's talking about, which muscles are supposed to work at which point. Mm-hmm. And then when the seminars came around, we had to make a decision of what's the best approach of teaching, of giving as much information as possible. And our goal was to give 110% of the information that the people that are there would be able to understand. So, you know, we give as much as possible.
Yeah. Now, was it difficult? I mean, because I imagine even though they, you know, those lifters come from a very similar school, I'm sure they had some differences amongst themselves. Were there ever, you know, arguments about, like, you know, nitty-gritty sort of technique things, or
absolutely,
yeah.
So since I was the translator and the MC of the seminars, I had a notepad with me, with which before the seminar started, we would like sit down and discuss every minute of the seminar, what's supposed to happen, what we're supposed to discuss. And at first, it was just my friend Nikita and Vasily and myself for the first seminar, and Vasily was obviously the best weightlifter among us, and he had the trump card of, no, this is how it's done.
Yeah.
But for me to be able to translate and explain it, I need to understand the logic. So it was like a thorough discussion of why he says it this way, and from my side, I was pushing back, saying, yes, but not for this demographic. We need to say it in a different way. So it was like that kind of discussion. Then the following seminars, when Klokov joined us, Klokov had the trump card over Vasily because Klokov's a Olympic medalist. Mm-hmm. And he would say, no, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of discussions, a lot of yelling, a lot of arguing on like the tiniest points. And these guys, I had to ahead of time ask any questions that I thought would be asked during seminars so that I could understand the question, how to translate it correctly into Russian so they understand. And mm-hmm. exactly what's meant, and if I can ask all the questions ahead of time, then that would be much easier. No. So I would ask a lot of questions that they've never answered out loud. Yeah. So it was a lot of their brainstorming out loud and arguing with each other, with their logic, and whatever came out on top, whatever we all agreed on, was what we kept.
Now, when I imagine Klokov and Vasily arguing / yelling, were there explosions? you know,
were certain cities leveled?
Mushroom clouds.
I have a really funny video from Florida. We were in Florida with Ilya was there already, and I think at least three people at all times were standing up and saying no, like this, no, like this, no, like this, showing where the hit's supposed to happen in the clean, and so, like. There are other people turning around in the restaurant. Like, why are these people up at all?
Yelling in Russian. And
so were and hitting themselves on the lap. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Were there specific things where in these discussions, I mean, you and we've talked a little bit about this before, about how you realized once you had three of them that you had to go over this in advance, but were there certain points where, despite the discussion, despite the advanced prep, the three of them simply did not see eye to eye on certain methodologies or on certain of these finer points. They're just ways that fundamental ways that their approaches diverged.
So all of them have the same base technique. So for the first number of years as they're growing as athletes, all of them were taught the same technique. And then only after a certain amount of time, it changed based on their specific body types. Mm-hmm. So they have the base understanding the same. But at the same time, there were some minor things that each one of them picked up over the years because of their body type that was more important to them. Like Ilya, the way that he holds his wrists and elbows in the snatch and the jerk catch. Mm-hmm. That's something that the other guys don't do, never thought of, because it was never an issue for them. And Ilya was very adamant about, like, specifically, no, this is the best way, this is why. And the other guys, not that they really disagreed much, they just didn't care, and to them it was also new.
Okay.
Yeah, and each one of them had some things that they were saying was more right. Vasily doesn't have any flexibility at all.
Really?
So, yeah. And when
he gives me hope as a lifter.
Well, I think squatting, you know, 350 kilos also, you know, that helps.
It's helpful, yeah. But when you talk about technique and how high you need to pull something, if you can't squat below parallel, then you have to pull a little bit higher.
Yeah.
So some differences with that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, when you even just looking at Vasily and Klokov, I mean, those are two guys, you know, relatively in the same bodyweight class and vastly different body types. So, I mean, there's no way that you can be doing the exact same things to produce the same results.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Now, you recently did another seminar with, I think his nickname is Misha, right? I mean, is that what a lot of his friends call him?
Yeah, that's like the familiar for Mikhail.
Yeah. And I actually shook his hand a few years ago at the Arnold, and I was supposed to lift, and I think I bombed out in the meet, and I blame it on that handshake. I'm pretty sure he crushed a few metacarpals or something.
It was probably a delicate balance between him crushing the metacarpals and you absorbing something through his sweat. Because I was at that Arnold as well. And I stood by him and was simply in awe of the amount. Misha, I mean, he's big. But what's impressive about him is I think he's actually twice as big in reality, but he has packed himself into that size. Like, he looks like 400 pounds stuffed into 250 or whatever he actually weighs. He's the most solid object I've ever encountered.
Yeah.
Really an amazing mountain of a man.
And so how was your experience traveling with him? And it, was it his coach, Boris Shako? Is that?
It's not his coach. It's so we wanted to do a powerlifting seminar with Boris Shako. And Boris Shako, if you don't know who he is, he's the most decorated powerlifting coach of all time, or at least one of. Yeah, he's when he was the head coach of the Russian national powerlifting team for 7 years, they won worlds 7 years in a row.
Wow!
And before that, he was the Olympic weightlifting coach for the juniors in Kazakhstan, for the juniors and school age of the Soviet Union.
Wow.
And he's just a wealth of knowledge. He's a professor of powerlifting in Russia, the only professor of powerlifting.
Wow, that's a nice title.
Yeah, and he's developed his own system for training in powerlifting, which he took from the Soviet weightlifting system. He adapted it to powerlifting.
Wow.
And with him, we decided that we wanted to do some seminars because for me, I love the learning opportunity. Mm-hmm. And it's not that interesting if it's just some guy that I have to translate for that's lecturing for hours and hours. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to bring a popular powerlifter that can put on a good show.
Absolutely.
And that was Misha Kaklaev.
I'm wondering, did Misha talk at all about, because he's been pretty outspoken about the political component of weightlifting in Russia and at the world stage. Did he talk at all about that with you during your times? And did the other lifters talk about that at all?
Everyone talked about it, but everything was left until after the seminars were done. Like, we had the thorough discussions, but everything that had to do with politics, whether within the sport or within the country, was left until afterwards. There was nothing really that interesting that, like, I haven't read about him before that.
Yeah.
That he talked about the Russian weightlifting, but he just said that he was not on good terms with them because he was always doing his own thing.
Mm-hmm. And do you get the sense that that's why we never saw him on the international stage, really? Because he had impressive numbers. I mean, Misha, I think, was snatching around 200, clean and jerking around 250
yeah,
or so.
Yeah, close to 250, yeah.
One thing about his snatch, Tatiana Kostrinina's coach, who was around him when he was around Kaklaev when he was at his best, said that if the weightlifting bars were longer, then he would have been the first person to snatch 220. And I think the NBA has bars that are longer, and the Soviet Union used to have bars that were longer, and Kaklaev, the first time that he snatched 200, was with a bar that was longer.
You longer know, than the when I see some of those super heavyweights, especially that are long-limbed, it looks like they're squeezing their body into these tiny little bars to get underneath. It really is too bad. And, you know, another argument people would make on the other end of that is that the width of the bar, especially for these guys in the, like, 56 or even lesser classes back earlier on, you know, they just have these small fingers and small hands, you know, to deal with that. So it's definitely a disadvantage when you look at the extremes of body weight and size.
Yeah, and at this point, the women's bar for the super heavy women is kind of ludicrous. There was an interesting article about the women's bar in the European Weightlifting Federation Scientific Magazine. We might have talked about this last time, but the fact that bar was designed when the women's world record clean and jerk was 155.
Wow.
And I don't know that anybody back then thought we'd see a 193 clean and jerk, which is what Tatiana's done. And we're probably going to see, I mean, I think it's only a matter of time before, certainly we see 195 and ultimately 200 or more.
Right. And as it is now, I mean, when you see Tatiana in the bottom of her squat, you know, front squat and catching a clean, I mean, it looks like the weights are going to touch the
ridiculous
ground.
it really is ridiculous.
So
do you get the sense then that because Misha was so unwilling to work within the system that they didn't use him for that? Because if he could have done 220 or so on a better bar, you'd think they would have taken him and at least trained him to do like 215 on the bar that he's currently using. Was it just that he was such a problem to handle or something else?
I'm sure it was a combination of a lot of things. That if someone was less of a problem than he was, and even if they lifted a little bit less than him, it may be safer to take them. But it's all politics. The head coach decides who he wants to take, and you know, emotional decisions get made.
That's interesting.
Now, generally speaking, during these seminars, you know, everyone's looking for those golden nuggets, you know, to take home to their own training, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm always interested in what happens in between, meaning, okay, yes, these guys are working out and they're lifting big weights, they're working on technique, et cetera, et cetera. But what about the time in between? I mean, are they just like bears sleeping hours on end, you know, shoveling food into their mouth and just closing their eyes and resting in between sessions? I mean, what's going on in between these?
Everyone's different.
Yeah.
Everyone's different. Like Tatiana Kashirina is the perfect athlete. Everything does by the book, has never missed a training session, has never done anything that she's not supposed to, because she has a goal and she's going to reach everything.
Yeah.
Almost everyone else does not live that lifestyle.
if you don't want to incriminate anybody.
No, but much further than you assume. Like, you know, everyone assumes that the best athletes don't smoke cigarettes, don't drink anything, and they do much, much more than you would assume.
Yeah.
They're just like, you know, normal guys this age,
yeah,
whose careers are weightlifting and not programming.
Yeah,
I remember going to my first Worlds 2010, and I was astounded by the fact that pretty much every nearly every A-session athlete was smoking. a lot, and the Chinese athletes especially. I remember, I think it was Louis Yang, seeing him there. I mean, I don't think the guy, except for when he was actually on the platform, was not smoking, but otherwise, it was pretty constant.
What?
And drinking, yeah.
Same after a good attempt, walks to the ashtray, picks up the still lit cigarette.
There is a video of a meet from the 90s where a Russian athlete does finish. I think it's a Russian, although it might have been a Hungarian or Ukrainian, finishes smoking and then goes out to the platform.
So from what I understand, a lot of the lifters, I'm not going to say where I got this, between the snatch and the clean and jerk, go to the bathroom to smoke. And
really?
All of them are surprised when they see half the rest of the guys that they're competing against also smoking in the bathroom.
So it's sort of a hangout, like, okay, let's take a break, let's rest our legs, and let's smoke a cigarette.
Being in high school, it's like in between classes. I remember seeing
it's the cool kids.
That's right,
the cool kids. The A session smokes.
I remember seeing a post by the other main resident, Ivan Rojas. He was talking about, there was a Bulgarian, I think it was when he and his wife went to Bulgaria, and they were talking about one of the Bulgarian or Azerbaijani lifters there, and they broke down his training program, and it was like the first thing was smoke a cigarette, and yeah, the second thing was lift, and then in between snatch and clean and jerk, he would smoke another cigarette. And
four out of five Bulgarian doctors recommend it.
And those guys, I mean, they're at the forefront of medical technology, so This might be what's holding my own training. But Dr. Westbrook, perhaps this was what failed our race to mediocrity.
It's never too late, guys.
This is the golden nugget I've been looking for, cigarettes. And fortunately, where I am in Maine, I mean, I can find them anywhere and everywhere.
And probably
too bad you're moving to New Hampshire.
I know, right? It is too bad. I got to get another 2 months of training and smoke cigarettes.
Training and smoking, exactly.
And that's... wait for the weights to pile up.
So presumably that was not Tatiana. That was not her case, though.
No. Well, I mean, if you recall in 2011 at Paris, I mean, she won the silver medal at the Worlds, broke at least one world record, and was just bawling her eyes out in disappointment. So, I mean, you're talking...
She was thinking I should have been smoking.
She probably was.
Should have been in the bathroom with... who'd she lose to? Lou...
Lulu Zhu, yep, that's right.
Should have been in the bathroom smoking with her. I don't know that she was actually smoking there, but...
Well, the first, you know, high-caliber weightlifter that I saw smoking was a Chinese weightlifter, Liu Yong, infamous, or the famous 85-kilogram lifter, and I remember being blown away.
Yeah, no, I think he was one of the first ones I saw, too. It was at... it was in Turkey. I think it was Turkey 2010, although it might have been... the following year. But yeah, Turkey, everybody was smoking at the Worlds there.
Well, that needs to be added to our to-do list if we want to improve, I guess.
Clearly, this is the training secret. Yasha, I'm wondering if you could talk about how the different mindsets of the athletes you've encountered. Because with Tatiana, I saw a little bit of this, and you mentioned this too, the idea that she really seems focused on weightlifting, understandably so. And even when asking her what she enjoys outside the gym, it seemed to be that mostly she enjoyed the gym. And that time outside the gym was like a distraction to prevent her from thinking about the gym, essentially. What were some of the other athletes like in that regard?
Oof.
You know, specifically, and I don't know if you're sort of hinting at this too, but specifically Ilya Ilyin is what I'm really interested in.
I'm curious about all of them. But, yeah, I mean, Ilyin, I think, is an interesting case in particular because he took all that time off.
Right.
And he, I think, specifically requested all that time off. So, yeah, it's interesting to hear, like, you know, with some athletes, I mean, the standard line when you see an athlete get interviewed in this country is – these are crushingly dull people because to be that good, they...
Yeah, so about these guys, they're very far from dull. All of them have personalities. None of them are alike. They're all very different.
Yeah.
I guess the guys I can talk about most are Ilya, Ilyin, Klokov, Vasily, and Kaklaev. Ilya Ilyin, he's just a party everywhere he goes. So if we're staying in the same hotel room in different rooms, when we're both like scheduled, we all know that we have to get up at 7:30 to go get breakfast. When he sees me in the hall every single morning, he comes up to me and gives me a big hug and says, "It's great to see you." And he does this to like everyone that he knows. On the first day that he saw me, he was a little shy of doing that. But like every day after that, it was just, like, start with a big smile, a big hug, and like, let's have a great day. And then, like, he spent so much energy the whole day, either like singing along with whatever music was on, or dancing around, or coming back to the gym after the seminar, after we eat, to coach people, just because he wanted to coach people. But he had just a lot of energy.
Wow!
That by the evening, when like if Klokov and Vasily took a nap for the whole day, they wanted to go out and party at night. Ilya, for the most part, would be already really tired by then because he used up all the energy that he had doing whatever he did that day.
Wow.
There's a great video that somebody posted recently of, I think it was a Kazakhstani member, national team member, you know, hitting a PR of some sort. And then he comes out and does the most amazing dance that I think I have ever seen after somebody completes a lift.
He's got moves.
And it wasn't even him doing the lift. That's what was amazing.
You know, some of those videos that Gregor has posted on All Things Gym of that Kazakh team, Ilyin always looks like he's having a great time.
Yeah.
And he loves it. He loves the life. He has everything planned ahead, but at the same time, it takes every day as it goes. He's different from everyone else in the sense that he kind of feels that he has a gift, mm-hmm. and that he's destined to be great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with that mindset, when you have like that kind of confidence, you're gonna do well.
Well, it's great to also see that kind of confidence does not translate to any arrogance. You know, and there's a vast difference there. And there's some, you know, especially coaches and things who sort of, you know, say that in order to have this ultimate fierce competitor that they have to almost be arrogant in their confidence. But I think he's a great example of not needing to cross over that line of arrogance and confidence.
Well, he says that he's going to train as hard as he can. He's going to have a plan. And his goal is to be able to lift not any specific weight, but one more kilogram than his opponent.
Yeah.
And if he's not able to, then he just says, that's the way it is.
Now, obviously, he's probably the most fierce competitor in all of weightlifting, but I remember seeing you and Ilya had a little bit of a snatch competition.
It was kind of an international competition.
And what was the final result?
The final result was I snatched 140. Mm-hmm. No, so this was at the end of a long workout where we did many attacks or waves.
Yeah.
And I kept going to 140 as my last weight, and he kept going to 120 because he weighed, like, I don't know, 85 kilos after a year of not lifting.
Yeah.
And then to show me up, he put 141 on there, and he snatched that.
Not surprising. There we go. 1 kilo more. His goal.
1 kilo more, yeah. But I put on 142. I missed that, and then the one after that, after a little pep talk from him, I got that.
Oh, really? Okay. So
that's cool that he gave you the pep talk too. Yeah.
He didn't add 143 and attempt it. He said, "Yeah, we're done. You got this."
He knows when he's beat. No, but then the clean and jerks. We both got to 140, and he told me not to go any heavier.
And you listen to Ilya when he tells you something.
Yeah, you have to listen to Ilya. He knows his stuff.
Did you ever talk about what he did with that year off?
Yeah, he asked the Kazakh Federation if he can just take a year off to do whatever. He got a really good amount of money for winning the Olympics. And he traveled, learned English, got married, and then I guess that's it. That's all I know. I know he did a lot of like adventure sports. Like he did a lot of running and biking and swimming.
Really?
All that kind of stuff. Yeah. Hmm.
Do Klokov and Polovnikov and Misha? Do they do other sports as well? Or do you have a sense that they have other things outside weightlifting that is interesting to them?
Yeah, all of them have hobbies. All of them have things outside of weightlifting that they're interested in.
What? Okay, I cannot picture Polovnikov with a hobby.
I just saw a photo of him on a jet ski, so perhaps jet skiing is one of his hobbies.
How did they get him? It's like a bear riding a bicycle.
His leg was bigger than the jet ski. One leg.
I need to hear these hobbies, Yasha.
So Polovnikov, Vasya, he is really into music. He plays the piano really well.
Polovnikov.
Yeah.
Piano.
Yep.
With his fingers.
And really well. Yeah.
Really? Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
when
fantastic.
We were in California, we went to my aunt's house. To my cousin is a prodigy, a piano prodigy. And the two of them just jammed for a while. And it was very cool to watch. That was the first time I saw Wesley play piano, and he just never said anything about that before.
That's amazing.
And he's like, let me sit down next to you. And they just jammed for a while.
Wow. And I've heard rumors that Klokov likes to draw. Is that true?
I don't know.
No. Okay. Do you know?
No, maybe. I don't know.
I know he's a bit of a family guy. Any hobbies outside of his family, that sort of thing?
From what I understand right now, everything is devoted to growing his brand. I don't think he has enough time to do anything outside of that.
Yeah.
I know that before he was the guy that would... Actually, never mind. I'm not going to say it.
Okay.
I don't know if you would want people to know. No, it's something bad. It just, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously his, you know, team winner, which is, you know, sort of the Cloak-Off brand, yeah, he dedicates a ton of time to that and is doing seminars with another Olympian, and I believe Olympic gold medalist, Dmitry Berestov. I'm probably butchering that name again. I apologize. Yeah, yeah, just like that. and it looks like it's a great seminar because you're actually brought into the Russian, a very traditional sort of Russian training facility.
Yeah, from what I understand, they invite some of the best coaches and minds and strength from around Russia, including Boris Shako, the powerlifting coach.
Oh, really?
And wow. they get lectured, and they live the lifestyle of weightlifters, which is awesome, which you can't get from any seminar in America because you can't cover that in 6 hours.
Right, right.
And that's another really interesting thing that before meeting these folks, I thought that the weightlifting system, Russian weightlifting system, is technique or program or, you know, something along those lines. But it involves like much more in terms of the lifestyle, in terms of like going to the bathhouse is something that in your ledger, your workout ledger, is in there for every Russian athlete, that they have to go once, twice, three times a week.
Really?
And it's a part of their everyday lives. And when they come here and see that athletes don't do that here, it's just a surprise to them. Like, well, how do you guys recover then?
Right, right. So like you said, it's they're sort of recommended 2 to 3 times a week at least?
1 to 3 times a week, not more than that.
Yeah, I see. Wow.
And it's to the point of it's absolutely mandatory, and right. It's a part of their life. And I'm sure that they do in the Russian training camp that they're doing right now, that they do many things that are of that sort that you just would never get as a weightlifter in America.
So it's as important as squatting almost.
You gain your strength when you recover yeah. Well, and without it, you can't. I think you can do well without doing squats, and without recovering well, you can't do well.
Interesting. Well put.
In the conversations with the Russians, and I am a huge fan of all the Russian lifters. I love the technique. I very much enjoy the bathhouse lifestyle. I mean, if I had a sauna out here, I'd be there the maximum 3 times a week. that said, they have not won an Olympic gold since 2000, I think. Is that correct?
I think so, yeah.
So have they discussed this at all? Is there some sense? I mean, Tatiana, I think, was out maybe the closest recently. Shigashev was obviously quite close in 2008. But otherwise, yeah, they've been edged out for gold. Do they talk about this at all? Is there some sense that they're not focusing on the Olympic Games? No?
No. It could be that it was just not discussed, but it seemed more like it's an individual sport. You know, they care about what they themselves did, not what the team did. I mean, like in America, like, you know, we care that our team isn't the best, but we care more about our individual performance or the individual performances of our favorite athletes.
What's their... I mean, here there's a great sense of respect for other athletes. And maybe not respect, but there's admiration for the Russians, certainly the Chinese. Are there athletes that when you were traveling with Vasily or Ilya that they really liked? Who maybe you were surprised to hear?
I guess the
past
only...
or present.
Are you talking about American lifters?
Well, I wasn't guessing that they were really in awe of American lifters, but that might be.
So they were all in awe of Tommy Kono.
And really?
They discussed it thoroughly, how without him there wouldn't be the Russian system or what it is today.
Really?
How big of an influence it was that they had training videos of his, and they used any information that they got because he was the most successful weightlifter of that time.
Mm-hmm. What if,
amazing. There's
not a better compliment that anyone can get than what you just said about Tommy Kono.
And they actually got to meet Tommy Kono, and they were, you know, like fanboys.
Really? Wow. That's amazing.
But what's interesting is I am willing to bet that a lot of our listeners probably are unfamiliar with Tommy Kono or don't really know a whole lot about him. But, I mean, he was one of – is one of the greatest. He's still alive. He's 85 years old. He's one of the best Olympic weightlifters in the history of the sport. I mean, I'm just looking at some of his information on Wikipedia. I mean, he won – he won at the Worlds. He won, looks like, 6 gold medals at the Worlds. He won 2 Olympic gold medals, 1952 and 1956. He won a silver medal in 1960. I mean, his, and, you know, medals at the Pan Am Games, more medals at the Worlds, bronze and silver in addition to all those golds.
And set world records in 4 different weight classes.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing, too.
And interestingly, he's Japanese-American, and so he spent part of his youth in an internment camp during World War II, because he's born in 1930, and then his family's relocated to one of these camps, and it's there, I think, that he starts lifting. So that is fascinating.
And from what I understand, also a bodybuilding champion.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he won Iron Man Mr. World title of 1954. So, yeah, I mean, you know, sort of successful in many avenues of strength training, which is fantastic.
And deserves the admiration.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I haven't heard much from him recently. I don't know if either of you know. I know he lives in Hawaii. He was on the board of directors for part of the time that I was on there, and he would call in, but then he resigned, and I don't know what he's up to recently. Do you guys know?
I haven't heard anything of Tommy Kono in his later age. Besides, you know, I did see when you guys were there in Hawaii that there was an interaction between the lifters and Tommy Kono, which was pretty cool.
Yeah,
that is very cool. Were there other lifters that they mentioned? I mean, Tommy Kono, I think he was like, you know, on Time Magazine or something. He was huge, obviously. Were there other, either American or international lifters who they really felt were important to the sport or they really liked to watch?
I think that they were a little bit bitter towards other lifters that are currently active because, you know, everyone that trains as hard as they do have the admissions that they do feel that they are the best. So anyone else that does well. Except it was interesting, Ilya said that he's never been on YouTube and looked at other lifters.
Really?
Until at some dinner after a seminar, someone hands him a phone with a Chinese lifter, one of the best Chinese lifters, I don't remember who it was. And Ilya was just mesmerized staring at it for like half an hour. Everyone wants to talk to him, but he was, for the first time, watching lifting on YouTube.
That's amazing.
His first time watching lifting on YouTube was like 2 years ago. It is kind of amazing. I mean presumably they have YouTube in Kazakhstan.
Maybe it's filtered. Who knows? But I mean, to think that some of his videos, especially of his latest world event, I mean, probably has in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of views.
Oh yeah,
that's pretty impressive.
And what about Vasily and Klokov? The same way. I mean, Klokov was sort of at the end of his career. Were there people that he looked up to?
No, or at least not that I know of. I mean, he was at the top of his game in terms of popularity. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people, I think the biggest motivator for people is being popular, being liked by others. And like, in some way, he achieved that at that point, and I don't think he cared that much about actual results or looking at other lifters.
Now,
I may be wrong, but
did he talk about while you guys were together talk about his aspirations to lift or not to excuse me not to lift but to compete in a bodybuilding competition? Because I know he did that. Was that about a year ago now, or maybe less than that? Was that something that he just, you know, sort of want to check off the list, or you know, I know he had been sort of an admirer of Arnold Schwarzenegger and his fame. So did that have?
No. He said that Arnold Schwarzenegger is his idol in terms of someone that left a strength sport and became a star.
Yeah.
His big thing was he didn't want to do any sport after that. it seemed like his big goal was to be as good of an influence and ambassador for the sport as he can be. Mm-hmm. Like in a very nice way. Like he didn't know how because he came from a very sheltered life in a closed country in a training center. But when he was out and about doing seminars, I think that's why he still hasn't stopped, because he saw how that he can go places, teach people. So his, at the time, aspirations was just how much good could I do with the name that I have for the sport of weightlifting?
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, Sean, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit, and some of these lifters are maybe a little young for this, but there must have been a shift in what things were like prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union and then after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Did you ever talk about that with these lifters or with the coaches, and what it was like leading up to 1990, 1991, and then how things have changed or stayed the same maybe since then?
So with the athletes, we never really discussed it because they all grew up in Russia, not Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. I was 5'6" when the Soviet Union fell apart. And all of them were at pretty much the same age. So that didn't get discussed. It was discussed a little bit with one of the coaches that I've spent time with, an older guy. I would rather not say which one, but the sentiment was, just growing up in a communist country or a country striving to be communist, was that we're stronger together than we are separate. Just like Russia's not as strong as it would be as if it was together as the Soviet Union was. And the comparison was like the United States. If the states were all separate, they would be weaker separately than they are together as the United States. And it's a shame that something collapsed that wasn't perfect, but they were happier before.
Really? Well,
this was in the words of the one coach, yeah. Or more than one coach, okay.
In the words of one coach who grew up and had a good life during the Soviet Union, so it's understandable that he would like that lifestyle.
Right, right.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you left after the fall, then, is that correct?
I left in 1990, so right as it was falling apart.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay. Wow. And did your parents leave because of the impending collapse, or reasons unrelated?
So we came here as Jewish refugees, because at that point, before that, no one was allowed to leave the country, because the only reasons why someone would leave the country is because they don't like it. And that means, you know, you don't want people that don't like Russia to be in other countries, so you wouldn't let them out. Mm-hmm. Except for some situations when Jews were allowed for religious reasons.
Sure.
And so we left right at that point when the gates opened and we were allowed to leave.
Wow.
But now you've been back since then, though, correct?
Nope.
No, you have not.
I have not.
I thought you had.
No.
Do you have any interest in going back?
Or
plans?
I do.
Okay.
I don't have plans, but I think I will in the near future. Up until recently, I was of military age. And because when you leave a country, you don't necessarily get rid of the citizenship. Mm-hmm. And although my passport from when I was 5 expired, if I was to go back to Russia, they can still consider me a citizen, because why am I not a citizen?
Right.
Interesting.
I could have been taken into the army.
Wow.
Up until I was 29.
Wow.
Up until you were 29.
Yeah. Imagine going there. You know, I'm as American as any other American. I grew up here. And then being told I have to go to the army of the country that, you know, we kind of fled.
All of a sudden, you're there on vacation, and before you know it, yeah, you're like a tank gunner somewhere.
Right.
I just came here to lift weights, guys. I don't know what I'm doing in this tank.
Wow, that's incredible.
do the athletes, from what I understand, athletes in a lot of other countries do end up having to do military service of some sort. Like, I think Piros Dimas was like a general in the army or something. Is that the case for the Russian lifters as well? Do they all have mandatory military service? And it just...
Yes.
It is. Okay. So how does that get taken? Is snatching like an official military job or...
So from what I understand, everyone has to right now serve 1 year. Mm-hmm. And there are different positions where, like, you do have to be part of the army. You have to go through some sort of ROTC. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the army, if you are a specialist of some sort, whether an athlete or whatever else, you're allowed to continue your training in that environment. Meaning, okay, while still in the army, but
right,
you go to the gym and fully focus on that, or at least for most of the time.
Hmm. Less and distractions, probably.
Yeah. Do they go to school or something when they're training? I imagine at high school age they do, but what about when they're what we would consider college age, essentially, or are they just full time?
So everyone's a little bit different. There's a lot of, how do you say this properly? I won't say it properly. I won't say it at all. So.
Fair enough.
You know how in some schools life experience helps to, or unaccredited schools, life experience helps to get a degree?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
In some programs, because you spent your whole life in a gym and really do understand anatomy, physiology, and the biomechanics of the sport, you would know as much as someone that's been academically studying it for a long time. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they can go to college and get a full degree, knowing as much as anyone else would, but likely not having to go to class as much. So instead of going to a formal lecture class, they go every once in a while to specific theoretical lectures, but get most of their learnings in the gym.
Sounds like a lot of American athletes. Yeah. Not actually going to class, yeah, getting, yeah, degrees.
Well, I think a lot of people think they get degrees on Facebook, but it doesn't exactly happen.
Now, Yasha, are there American athletes? I'm sure there are. What are the American athletes whose lifting you really like at this point, or whose technique, or who impress you? I'm assuming there are. If not, you could do me.
No, there absolutely are.
Okay.
Right now, most of the guys at the Olympic Training Center are killing it.
Yeah.
Like the ones that I've been watching for a while are all improving, and like all of them. Like there's some things that I think you can tell an American lifter does differently from other lifters. Maybe it's that difference in understanding the concept of the lift, just some parts of it. But as individuals outside of the training center, Jared Fleming, mm-hmm, I think has just excellent chances to do really well. Mm-hmm. Kendrick Ferris, when he's on, he's on.
Yeah.
CJ Cummings, he's too young right now. I think it's, if he matured slower, maybe he would have a longer career. I hope that it's a long career and he does really well. As of right now, he's obviously setting records and doing great, and technique looks great.
Is he old enough to be considered master of sport in the Russian system? Because isn't there an age cutoff?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's at 15.
15, okay. Wow. So he's in that age bracket.
And I believe you posted on either your Facebook page or maybe it's on your blog, just sort of a quick breakdown of where you sort of sit within each weight class to you know, sort of be master of sport, mm-hmm, which is a really, really interesting chart to look at if any of our listeners get a chance to do that. And your blog is Yasha's Thoughts, is that right?
Yasha Thoughts,
gotcha. So
check which has out. Been a great site. I have been enjoying reading that, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Thank insights you. are really fantastic. And I'm wondering if you could, because you mentioned that there are things you note in lifters that would maybe not coincide with what you've learned or experienced. And I wonder if there are large aspects, like the biggest one perhaps that you note in lifters where the Russian system would say, nope, that's absolutely not. Like you mentioned earlier, you know, the long pull that Polovnikov mentioned. Were there other big things that you that don't align?
I'm sure there are. It will take some time in discussion. For instance, just the term rigidity that I never thought of before. You know, you have strength, you have speed, you have endurance, but also the ability to stop in place. And I never trained for that. I didn't think that was an important feature to have.
Yeah, Dr. Westbrook, you and I have talked about this a little bit, I think, when we were discussing the way there's a great video of Artem Okulov doing a set of five snatches.
Yep.
And he catches each one. And I mean, rigidity, again, it's not a term I would have thought to use, but it's he catches each one, punches it out, and that's it. That's where he catches it. And
right.
He is solid. Yeah, wherever he catches it, and each one gets a little lower, wherever he catches it, he is 100% solid.
And that's a part of the programming. That's a part of the training, that if you have the rigidity, then you're much less likely to get injured.
Yeah.
In the first phase of a long training cycle, you have to start building rigidity so that you can withstand the weight that you're going to be throwing later. Because if you're strong enough to lift something, but not strong enough to stop it, then you're not going to be able to finish the lift.
Right, yeah. And in addition to Artem Okulov, even Apti, you know, when you see him on the competition platform, when he does his three attempts, there's always a degree of like you said, rigidity that changes from, I shouldn't say the rigidity stay the same, but the area of which where they catch it, where he catches it, is different. But again, he's rigid at that moment when the catch happens.
Yeah, there's no softness. Whenever, if the bar gains momentum, and that's momentum they have to stop on the way down, if you have the rigidity to stop it, then it's a much easier lift.
Right, right.
And there's a lot of exercises, a lot of variations of the exercises to specifically build rigidity, which it just wasn't a part of my vocabulary before.
Yeah. Yeah. In my short period where I trained with you and Vasily for, I think it was only about two or three workouts or so, he kept stressing with me to do drop snatches where you were really actively catching it at the point that you dropped underneath it. So, again, he didn't use the word rigidity, and he wasn't necessarily trying to explain it in that way, probably because he didn't have the words to explain it in that way. But now as you say that, I think that was the point that he was trying to get across to me.
And that's the problem that I had with him at the beginning also, because I didn't understand what he's talking about, like what the point is or what exactly he wants us to do.
Right.
But it's a lot of, you know, small concepts like that, which they all have a firm understanding of that's the way a lift is supposed to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I just didn't.
And even, I mean, and not just these Russian weightlifters or weightlifting coaches, but even things earlier on when we were training years ago at Norwood, I remember these little keys that, you know, Dennis Reno would mention, elbows out or thumbs along the rib cage, things like that, that at the time that you just sort of say, yeah, I sort of get it. But then as you really thoroughly think of that, you almost create a different mentality about those little cues that on the surface just seem like such a simple thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yasha, I'm wondering if we could return for a moment to the question that this is what Kathy Hui asked of Dr. Westbrook and I earlier, which is how we started weightlifting, but also how we developed a real love for weightlifting. Now, was there a point where you thought, I really love weightlifting? And if so, at what point was that?
I trained for wrestling nonstop for years and then transitioned into weightlifting, trained nonstop. And I didn't really love it. I just needed to compete in something. And then there was a period when I hurt my back and I wasn't able to lift. And that's when I got the craving.
Really? Yeah. So it wasn't until you stopped it that you realized.
Yeah. And then when I came back, I was so much happier. I was back to being myself, which was a weightlifter.
Yeah.
Dr. Westbrook, when did you realize? Was it just immediate or?
Well, I wouldn't say it was really immediate. I mean, it was a love that grew and continues to grow. But when I really got to that point where I was saying to myself, this is something that I'm taking serious, was actually earlier on when I started lifting in Boston, which is sort of my first introduction into having a sort of small community of weightlifters who really felt all these similar things that I did, you know, because when you're training by yourself and sort of just in a small gym where other people are sort of doing bodybuilding or other things, you sort of think that you're on this little island and sort of you're this crazy person. But all of a sudden you get surrounded by other crazy people who love weightlifting and you say to yourself, wow, and it just enhances your whole experience. So really it was those couple of years with Yasha, with Joel Quintong, with Donnie Venerosa, that really it was that moment when I said, okay, I'm a weightlifter and I love weightlifting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting because it was, you know, like you mentioned the idea that back then you found a group of people and you realize, oh my goodness, these people are similar to me. They feel the same things about this sport. I don't know that it's possible to have that experience anymore, because it's so much more popular. I mean, it's not like baseball or anything, but it's so much more popular. I can't imagine somebody being like, oh my God, I just discovered this tiny community of people, because it's at this point, because of CrossFit, it's so much more popular. There are just, there are different communities, but there's more of them.
Right. Yeah. Back then it was, you know, smoke your rooms, weird handshakes to get in these back rooms to train. But now, I mean, you
smoking
can find
cigarettes with the A session guys in the bathroom.
Exactly. Now you can find, you know, a weightlifting gym, you know, pretty easily, even when you travel on vacation and things like that, which is a great benefit. But yeah, there's not quite that same sort of in intimacy that you have with a very, very small group of fellow weightlifters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, I would agree. I don't know if you've seen that as well, Yasha, or if any of the athletes you've traveled with commented on that, but it's a very different community and crowd now than even just 5 years ago, I would say.
Yeah. Well, another thing that we wanted to go through fast is a little discussion on the recently reviewed or recently released 2016 national qualifying totals. There's been some fairly significant changes, especially in the 77 kilogram men's class, 85, and even the 94s, which bringing up the 77 class to 269. 85 kilogram class to 281, and then the 94 kilogram class to 295. Now, the others changed also, but not nearly to the significance of these three classes. What are your thoughts on these kind of increases, especially when you're talking about a 77 weight class that jumped 19 kilos from the qualifying total last year?
Yasha, do you want to take that? Yep.
I'm trying to pull it up right now to see what the qualifying totals are so I can see in front of myself.
So I'll start by saying I think it's interesting that some of these jumps, the qualifying totals in at least a couple of these classes a few years ago would have gotten you a medal.
Oh, absolutely.
And now this is the qualifying total.
Right.
I think it's an interesting testament to how much the sport has grown and improved. I wonder if they're going to get the numbers. I mean, it's a tough game with the qualification numbers because you want enough athletes to make the meet worthwhile and profitable, obviously.
Right.
You don't want so many athletes that you have, like we saw last year. I mean, I think having between 50 and 60 athletes in one class is probably excessive, unless you want to make it, you know, a 4 or 5 day meet. Otherwise, you're running three platforms, which is not ideal.
It loses some of the specialness of being a national caliber lifter if you have 60 guys in your weight class.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the move is a good one, but any of these increases is going to be risky because then you could cut off more lifters than you anticipated. I think we saw that 2009, those nationals, they raised the total significantly and the numbers were pretty far down.
But you can always decrease the numbers, right? if they're not getting as many people to sign up, as many people to qualify, they can always decrease the numbers.
Right, yeah, and it's sort of strange, I mean, because even though they're releasing these totals now, this could all change.
It changes every year, right?
At any moment. Yeah, yeah. Every year it's different, right? But even these totals that they release, they could even say, you know what, we were just kidding, and we're going to drop these 5 kilos or 10 kilos, yeah, or whatever.
So, they had no problem changing the rule as they go along.
But it's really interesting to see that on the flip side of this story is the women's side had almost no changes.
Oh yeah, I don't understand. And those classes, some of them were really large,
huge classes. So I guess I'm not seeing in JP Nicoletta, Uncle JP, at the Weightlifting Mindset, his blog, you know, sort of talked about this a little bit, and looking at the way that they establish these numbers, it's hard to find any rational reason. It's not like a percentage of, you know, the best in the world from a previous year. It's nothing like that. So I think it's just a group of people just throwing numbers out and saying, let's do it.
Well, what it looks like they did in some of these cases. So in the 58s, for example, they went up 3 kilos, which is pretty small, but the 58s were a big class. I mean, the 58s went down over 30 athletes, but they were all pretty tightly clumped. And so basically they went down to 15th place, and 15th place is 163. Mm-hmm. And so last year's qualifying total was 160, and they just moved it up to that 163.
Right.
So I think in a number of these cases, what they did is just went to 15th place. I mean, interestingly, in the 63s, they didn't even do that. They left the 63s the same, which I don't understand, because the 63s, again, over 30 lifters. That said, a number of the lifters in the 63s did not even hit the qualifying total in the nationals. Mm-hmm. Right. So there must be interesting things going on with how lifters are actually qualifying. Let's just say that.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, looking at, you know, last year's numbers, and JP pointed this out in his article, you would actually have, I mean, with these listed and the lifters who lifted, you would actually have 140 men, or around 140 men, and around 160 women lifting. And again, there's one more weight class in the men's division than there is in the women's. So yeah, wouldn't you anticipate that to be the other way around? So it's sort of confusing. So really the weight classes in the women are going to have more lifters, which I don't know if they're trying to encourage, you know, female weightlifting more. I guess I'm a little confused on the rationale behind this whole chart.
Yeah.
Interesting nonetheless, and ultimately the fact that the numbers are going up, it's making the meet a more specialized meet and hopefully more competitive. I mean, the fact of the matter is you have to be snatching probably a 120 and clean and jerking around a 150 just to qualify for nationals as a 77, which, like you just mentioned, those are that could have been medals, you know.
Potential medal lifts not that long ago. Exactly.
Right. So that says a lot for weightlifting. I just hope they're not shooting themselves in the foot by sort of jumping them too high.
Yasha, I don't know if you want to add anything or if you had thoughts on that as well.
I want to know if these numbers are compared to the world records, because maybe it was that the women have been closer to the world records, and the qualifying totals for the last couple of years have been closer to the world records than the men's have been.
Could be.
Maybe that's why they're trying to push the numbers up.
Yeah, it could be.
Just to line them up as a percentage of the world records.
And really, I mean, within the last few years, we have seen, I mean, even our women become more and more competitive. I mean, it seems like some of these women that we're watching are just gaining huge amounts on their totals from year to year. So, It is getting more competitive. That's the bottom line for the United States, which is excellent.
Now, Yasha, do you plan on lifting at the 2016 Nationals?
No idea. I don't plan that far ahead.
You're not like Ilya. You're not planning, you know, 4 years ahead to make the gold.
I lifted yesterday, my first meet in a while.
I saw a video of this. Mike Graber, in fact, posted video at the meet. How did the meet go? Out of a little meet report.
It was very smooth. It was a very smoothly run meet in CrossFit Live Free in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. Dennis Reno was announcing, so felt like a national meet.
Nice. Nice.
A lot of good lifting. The women are getting really strong. Mm-hmm. The guys did well, too. All around good, relatively small meet. Everything ran smoothly.
Yeah. And how did you do?
I did as expected. I did 140, 165.
Well, that qualifies you for the 2016 Nationals.
Yeah.
If the numbers don't change, yeah.
If they don't change.
True,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm slowly building back up. Like I like competing every once in a while, so mm-hmm. I did that. Don't know if I will get back to training after this meet.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Now, Yasha, what do you enjoy aside from weightlifting? I mean, I know a little bit about your work. You work in a medical marijuana lab, correct?
Yeah, part of the time I work in a medical marijuana testing laboratory. I take on different projects, they're just different things that interest me. You know, the seminars, I did that for a month here and there. The medical marijuana laboratory, my brother is a chemist, and I had a business background, so I'm helping with that.
So you don't just have a background in smoking marijuana?
Not only that, no.
Not only that, okay.
Yeah, and just, you know, projects here and there. Doing fun stuff, and traveling as much as I can.
Very good, very good.
Now, are you going to the World Championships?
I don't know yet.
You don't know yet. You still have not decided. But
yeah, we're thinking about buying an old school bus, taking out the seats, and taking the whole team on a road trip to Houston.
That's really? A great idea.
That'd be fantastic. Yeah, that sounds like it'd be a lot of fun. Do you have... So one of our listeners, Harrison Wolf, asked about the Worlds and what we think our predictions are, or weight classes that will have good battles. And, future episodes we'll probably be able to talk about this more, just because right now we don't have a start list. We don't have any sense. I mean, for Kazakhstan, there's been a team posted. We have a sense of the Iranian team. Mm-hmm. The big names for me there are Rostami in the 85s and Salimi in the super heavies. But Yasha, are there, even though it's far out, are there teams or athletes or sessions that you're particularly interested in or excited about?
I think the only person that I know closely is Tatiana Tkachirina, who's going to be in the 105 and the 75 plus. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be exciting to watch. About the other ones, I really don't know, because I don't know the start list.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think we'll definitely hit on this more once we get the start list in our hands, and we'll be able to answer that question a lot more thoroughly, hopefully within even just the next week or two. I mean, we're less than a month out, so
yeah.
Really that start list really should be in our hands in the near future.
Yeah. Yep. And actually, I'm just looking at the time, and we're slightly over our 35-minute cap. we're just butting up at 36 minutes, I think. So,
we should
start to wrap things up.
And one addition I wanted to make, I still am looking for more trivia question answers.
That's right.
And again, the trivia question is, who is the lightest weightlifter of all time to officially an international meet lift 100 kilos, snatch 100 kilos above their body weight or more? And we've determined the prize for of all the correct answers, we will randomly select one probably within the next week or two. And that winner will receive a hook grip patch, a hook grip keychain, and none other than one roll of Bros thumb tape.
Wait, can I enter? I'll do what it takes for that roll. I don't know how you got this roll and why you're giving it. I didn't approve this, by the way.
It is worth its weight. It's probably worth two times its weight in gold. So. Probably.
That's a hell of a prize.
So start pouring in the answers.
All right. Well, Yasha, unless you have something you'd like to add to our listeners, I think we can start to wrap things up. Is there anything else you'd like to say or ask?
No, it's been a pleasure talking with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely, Yasha, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to future training sessions, especially living in New Hampshire so close to Boston in the near future.
Absolutely. Yeah, Yasha, I'd like to thank you as well. It has been a pleasure having you on, and we should probably thank our listeners as well for tuning in, and thanks to Kathy Gui and Harrison Wolf for submitting some questions. And those of you who are listening, make sure to check us out on Facebook, The Two Doctors, our website, thetwodoctors.net with the number two. We're on Twitter, Bafa Westbrook, at The Two Doctors, and on iTunes. And if you check us out on iTunes, leave us a rating, leave us some feedback, let us know what you're enjoying, what you like, what you don't like. We are always happy to hear feedback. But otherwise, Dr. Westbrook and Yasha, it has been an absolute pleasure.
Dr. Bafa, the pleasure is all mine.
Two Doctors, it's been my pleasure.
Thank you, and we'll see everybody next time.